Welcome to the second part of a two-part special about the great producer-songwriter Henry Glover. During this hour, you'll hear Brian Powers' interviews with several people who worked with Mr. Glover after his years at King Records. You'll hear from music historian Billy Vera, composer Artie Butler, musician Howard Johnson, blues guitarist Bob Margolin, and vocalist Peggy Santillia Ricker, plus music written and or produced by Henry Glover. I'm Lee Hay.
Hi, I'm Billy Vera. I'm a singer, songwriter, actor, also a music historian of sorts. Done about a couple of hundred reissue CDs and box sets. I won a Grammy for my notes on the Ray Charles box set. And I'm here to talk about the great Henry Glover, a man who I've grown to admire over the years, the more I study his work.
So can you talk about the circumstances of why Henry left King Records? And what did he do after he left King?
I've never been able to find out exactly why he decided to leave King around 1960, after the twist. But he went to a guy named Hi Weiss, who had a label called Old Town Records. And he co-wrote and produced a song called Let the Little Girl Dance by Billy Bland, which became a big rock and roll hit.
Little wallflower on the shelf, standing by herself. Never had the nerve to take a chance. So let the little girl dance.
Let the little girl dance. Let the little girl dance. She never danced before. So let her on the floor.
Let her on the floor.
Let the little girl dance.
But he was unhappy with the count, the royalty count that Hi Weiss gave him, so he left Old Town immediately, and he went over to Roulette Records, a fellow named Morris Levy, the infamous Morris Levy. And right away, he wrote a song for Joe Jones, a fellow that made a big hit with You Talk Too Much, and Henry wrote a song called California Sun.
I'm gonna go back out on the coast, where the California girls are really the most. They walk that walk, they talk that talk, they twist like this, they shimmy, don't you hear me? Yes, we're out there having fun in the warm California sun. The girls are frisky in the old Frisco. A pretty little misser wherever you go. They walk that walk, they talk that talk, they twist like this, they shimmy, don't you hear me? Yes, they're out there having fun in the warm California sun.
Which didn't do anything for Joe Jones on Roulette, but it later became a hit by a rock and roll group called the Rivieras. And so, you know, Henry started producing for Roulette, and he did the Cleftones, brought them their career back with Heart and Soul and I Love You for Sentimental Reasons, a group called the Essex. And Morris had a club called Birdland, jazz club, and he also was involved in another club called the Round Table. And he had connections in that whole Times Square area with all the clubs. I played a number of them myself. And they were all mafia-owned, including the Peppermint Lounge. And the little house band there was Joey D and the Starlighters. So someone got the bright idea to do an album with Joey D and the Starlighters. And so Joey and Henry concocted a twist number, because the twist was very big at the Peppermint Lounge, called the Peppermint Twist. And that became a gigantic hit.
Well, they got a new dance and it goes like this.
Then there was the album that had another hit record, Shout and Hot Pastrami and things like that. So Henry was now making gold records for this little guy, Joey D. But also while he was there, he got to produce some really classy music. He did Dinah Washington, an album called Dinah 62, which gave us the great hit, Where Are You?
Where are you?
Albums by Sarah Vaughan, which Henry felt were some of the best work of his career.
Untouchable. They said you were untouchable, and that you never could be. They said you were unkissable, and that I was a fool to dream your lover I could be.
And in gratitude, Morris Levy gave Henry his own label called Glover Records. On there, he recorded an act called Valerie and Nick, which was Valerie Simpson and Nick Ashford, who went on to much greater success later in the decade.
Gonna shop around.
Titus Turner, and together with Titus Turner, Henry wrote a song called Sticks and Stones, which became a big hit for Ray Charles when Ray went to change from Atlantic Records to ABC Paramount Records.
Now, as I understand it, one of the bands that he courted, I guess in the early 60s, maybe mid-60s, the Canadian Squires or something like that?
Oh, yes. Also on Roulette, Henry recorded Ronnie Hawkins and his band, which was called the Hawks. Like Henry, Ronnie was from Arkansas, as was the drummer, Levon Helm. But Ronnie and Levon had gone up to Canada, to Toronto, and become quite popular in the clubs up there. I mean, drawing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. So Roulette signed them, and they had a hit with a Chuck Berry song called 40 Days. Originally, it was called 30 Days when Chuck recorded it. And Henry did an album with them, and of course, that cemented a relationship between Henry and the band, which was called the Hawks.
I'm the talk of the neighborhood, 'cause I don't do what I should. I don't care what people say, I'm gonna do things my way. I think I'm growing.
And at one point, some years later, a few years later, the Hawks departed from Ronnie Hawkins and came back to the States and started playing clubs around, mainly on the Jersey Shore, where they were heard by Bob Dylan. And Bob Dylan wanted to go from being a folk singer, an acoustic folk singer, to having a rock and roll band behind him. And for that purpose, he chose the Hawks. And they were renamed The Band, and they became, for my money, the greatest rock and roll band of that era. I always say The Band put the roll back in rock and roll. But a few years later, when the band kind of went their separate ways, Levon Helm, the drummer, who sang The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, he contacted Henry and asked him to help him with a new band he was forming called the RCO All-Stars. And so Henry went up to Woodstock and helped supervise their recordings, including one that they made with Muddy Waters, which ended up being Muddy Waters' last album called the Woodstock Album.
Hi, this is Howard Johnson in New York, and I'm a musician known primarily for playing the tuba, but I have about as much to offer on the baritone sax and bass clarinet. And even though I've been in the jazz world since I came here, and that was one of the reasons I did come here, I've done other things with other kinds of bands. I played with the original live recording of The Band, which was called Rock of Ages, and also their sort of farewell concert in 76, which was made into a movie and recording called The Last Waltz. I did some arrangements for The Last Waltz, but one of the people who added horn parts to the band's music was Henry Glover, whose name I didn't know at the time. And then I found out that he was the one who not only wrote I'll Drown in My Own Tears, but he received the first, I think, BMI award for having the more than a million airplays for Drown in My Own Tears. So it was exciting to work with him on the things with the band. And he really helped those individuals, even though they weren't officially a band anymore. But he'd helped Richard Manuel with some things and Levon Helm with a lot of things. And I was part of that, too.
One of the albums that you played on was the Levon Helm's first solo album, the RCO All-Stars?
Yeah.
Do you have much memories about that project?
Oh, sure. We used the horn section from Saturday Night Live, which I had been in since some years before that. I was in the original band. I was the contractor for the original band on Saturday Night Live.
And that album also had a lot of other people. You had basically Booker T and the MGs, and you had Dr. John playing on it.
Well, that was his claim to all-stars. They are all-stars. But, you know, they all did some things that didn't fit in necessarily with their band presentations. And they could do them with Levon.
On the credits for that album, they have Henry Glover listed as band master. Can you maybe, do you have any idea of why he had that title, or do you have memories of what he was doing during those recording sessions?
Well, he was just being what was then known and hardly is anymore, an A&R man. Recordings for bands don't have A&R men anymore. They're either told what to play or not allowed to play it or something like that. But experts like Henry were already few by the mid-70s.
I noticed on that album there was a song that was co-written with Henry with Levon Helm called Blues So Bad. That recording session, was it over a long period of time, or did they knock that out fairly quickly?
Part we did. We didn't do very much with the rhythm section. We were just called in to put on the horns. It was fairly well organized.
Blues so bad I can't take on. Blues so bad I can't shake on. Blues so bad did I hurry to find a place just to worry. I try to drown them and drink, but what do you think? The blues can swim, they don't sink.
Hello there, this is Bob Margolin. I was in Muddy Waters' band in the mid-1970s when we did the Woodstock album, which was produced by Levon Helm and Henry Glover, and that's where I met him. I knew him for having written the incredible song Drown in My Own Tears. I later found out more about him, and I enjoyed working with him on that. It was over 40 years ago now.
How did you come about to end up being in Muddy Waters' band?
Well, I was in some bands that had opened up shows for him, and he saw that I was trying to play what he called old school Chicago blues, which is the raw and primitive music that he made around the time that I was born. But once I heard that music, I just fell in deeper and deeper. And I don't think Muddy went crazy over what a great guitar player I was, but he thought I could learn to play his music well. And he gave me a chance that put me on a road I'm still riding.
Do you have any idea how Levon Helm and Henry Glover hooked up with Muddy Waters to do this album in Woodstock?
I actually didn't do any of the business with it. I basically got told by Muddy, this is happening, and I'd like you to come along and play on this. He usually liked to have somebody with him from his band so he could have something familiar to play with. In the 1950s and 60s, it would usually be his piano player, Otis Spann, who passed away in 1969, I believe. But Muddy brought me and his piano player, Pinetop Perkins, with him to the Woodstock album.
As I understand, I think where they recorded it was a new studio that Levon Helm and Henry Glover had put together.
I'm pretty sure it was at Bearsville Studio, which I believe at least a partner in it, if not owning it, was Albert Grossman, who had been Janis Joplin and Bob Dylan's manager. And when we got to Woodstock the day before we actually did the playing, I remember we all went out for a meal with me and Muddy and Pinetop and Levon and Henry and Paul Butterfield and Albert Grossman. That's the only time I saw him during that time. He wasn't involved in the making of the records, but I think it was his studio, or at least he was a major partner in it.
What are your memories of the sessions? Were there was much prep work? I mean, did you already know what songs you guys were going to do? Or thinking back, how do you think all that was worked out?
I think probably Levon and Henry kind of chose some of the songs. There were some that Muddy wouldn't have come up with himself. They had an idea what they were doing, and me just playing guitar on it, I just got told what song we were going to play in this key. Maybe we'd run through it once, maybe not even that. Maybe Muddy would just do it. Muddy was very fast. He hardly ever needed more than one take to do a vocal, and he wasn't doing any overdubbing at all. He would just sing it strongly on the first take, and if the band sounded good too, you'd have a completed track.
So you cut that album live, I guess?
Well, live in the studio. It wasn't like there was an audience and we could stop if things needed to be changed, but we never stopped or overdubbed anything. We would maybe do a couple of takes of a song and get it and move on to the next one. Really didn't take very long.
And what were some of the other musicians that were playing on those sessions?
Well, Levon was playing drums, and Paul Butterfield was playing harp. Muddy knew Paul Butterfield from the Chicago days, and it was a thrill for me to play with him because when I was starting to get into the blues, his band was one of the ones I used to listen to a lot. So it was a real thrill. I was familiar with the band's music. I remember seeing them in about 1969 or 70, and of course, music from Big Pink and their subsequent albums were a big deal in the music world. Levon, I guess, had brought in a friend of him who played bass, and he played a little guitar on some of the two. I think that they may have overdubbed later, but Fred Carter was his name. And he was probably in his 40s by that time. But he could play blues real well, and he was a nice guy.
Do you have any memories of what Henry Glover was like on those sessions?
Yes, he was always very friendly and supportive and just let the music happen. He wasn't like making strong directions. He would talk with the musicians about a song and kind of a very basic arrangement that Muddy could lead with his voice, and then we would do it. But I do have a memory of, I think it was Henry had the idea of doing a Louis Jordan song, Let the Good Times Roll. Muddy had recorded another Louis Jordan song on that session, Caledonia, which Pinetop, the piano player that was in the band, used to sing that live at our shows sometimes. And Muddy said, I'm going to take that one from you, and the song Kansas City, too. But I remember when we were recording the Louis Jordan songs, which was Caledonia and Let the Good Times Roll, I was talking to Henry about it on the day that we were recording, and he said, anybody know what happened to Louis Jordan? I know he hasn't passed away. Is he okay? And I said, actually, I read in a newspaper that he was doing shows again. And then the next morning, I read a newspaper, and he had passed the day before while we were recording his songs. And I think Henry, you know, had the idea of having Muddy do Louis Jordan songs, which was interesting because their voices were very different. And Muddy kind of shouted the songs, and Louis Jordan kind of crooned them mostly. But we had a pretty good time jamming on it and having it come out with Levon's really heavy groove on the drums and a Muddy Waters version of Louis Jordan songs.
Good time roll. And I don't care if you're young or old, go out and let the good times roll.
Did return to King Records, where he stayed even after Sid Nathan passed away. But at that point, he was doing no music. He was just sort of overseeing the company. And the company meant nothing anymore, because by that time, James Brown had left, and there was really nothing left of the company. So there was not much to oversee.
Do you remember anybody in particular that you talked to who knew Henry, or what they had to say about Henry?
I talked to Joey D about him. And Joey said, oh, I loved Glover. He said he invited me to a couple of Dinah Washington sessions. I said, what happened? What was that like? I said, I heard she was a pretty crazy woman. He said, oh, yeah, she hit on me. And then my original songwriting mentor was a fellow named Chip Taylor. And Chip was signed by Henry Glover to King Records under his original name, Wes Voigt. Chip was the brother of actor John Voigt. And they both went to my high school a few years before I was there. Chip made four records, two sessions on King and Deluxe. And he said that Glover signed him because Sid Nathan's daughter saw Chip's picture and got a crush on him.
And what kind of music was Chip Taylor recording there in the late 50s for King or Deluxe?
Kind of a New York version of rockabilly. He had a band, a three-piece band called the Town Three. The other member of that band was a fellow named Greg Richards and another guy named Ted Darrell. Greg and Ted actually had success before anybody. They wrote a song called She Cried by Jay and the Americans. And then Chip eventually wrote Wild Thing and Angel of the Morning. And another good singer that Henry Glover recorded named Bruce Bruno. He made only two records, a chart record called Hey Little One on Roulette. Very good singer. In fact, Bruce Bruno wound up going to Canada to be with Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks because they needed a ballad singer. Bruce was an Italian kid who could sing like Johnny Mathis. And in fact, when they left Ronnie Hawkins, he remained with the Hawks. But he said when Bob Dylan found them, then they started to want to do Robbie Robertson's tunes. and Bruce didn't think Robbie Tunes had anything going for him, so he quit the band.
Why do you think Henry Glover is important, and why should he be remembered?
I think Henry Glover is important because of all the artists that he worked with, which were founding fathers of rhythm and blues and rock and roll, the broad swath his machete cut through the music business, so many different kinds of music, and the quality, the high quality. We always hear about the quality of Atlantic Records, and I was an Atlantic artist, and I've always been a big booster and fan of Atlantic Records. But in recent years, the more I listened to Glover's work, I don't think there was a better record producer working in the business at that time. I mean, you listen to those records, especially the records he made in the early 50s. You can hear every instrument, every note of every instrument. The recording is so clear. And the quality of the musicianship and the performances he got out of the background musicians, much less the singers, was just incredible. Incredible stuff, you know. He took terrific musicians and got great performances out of them.
Now, he's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but what is your thoughts on that?
I think he should be. I was a person who lobbied for getting Art Rupe of Specialty Records in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And for a long time, there was an East Coast bias to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, Glover is a great producer. Anybody that produced Drown in My Own Tears, The Twist, Fever, Good Rockin' Tonight, all those records deserves to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
My name is Peggy Santilia Ricker. I sang originally with a group called The Delicates. I sang with the Serendipity Singers. But my sort of main claim to fame is that I sang lead on a song called My Boyfriend's Back with the Angels, and that was in the 60s, but we are still close friends and still perform. I first met Henry Glover when I was probably 12 or 13 years old. The Delicates was a group I was performing with. We initially started in grade school. We met in second and third grade. Our beginning recordings, we sang and wrote Murray the K's theme songs. He was a DJ in New York for many, many years. We had some songs that were regional hits, but because we wrote and performed our own songs, we somehow got to court on United Artists and UNART initially, then United Artists, with Don Costa, who was also a very well-known arranger. Then one of our group members had to leave, and two of us went on to Roulette Records. I believe that is where we first met Henry Glover. You know, when you're that young, everybody seems old to you. What I remember about Henry Glover is he was super professional and very talented. He was really nice to us. He was a very talented, talented arranger, but he didn't keep himself separate. He was right in there in the studio and talking to us and making us feel comfortable. The change that he made in our lives, what I really appreciated, I was already thinking that some of the songs that we were recording on UNART and United Artists, they were sweet, but I wanted to sound more R&B and funkier. I felt like Henry Glover, with his arrangements, I think he really appreciated our natural ability to harmonize, and he gave us fabulous suggestions, which were easy to follow and great ideas.
Well, you were talking about he gave you advice. Was it like vocal advice, or was it just so how the arrangement of the song? Do you have much memories of how he articulated
well,
to you?
It was in a lot of different ways. One was, relax, girls, it's going to be okay. You can do it this time, you know, because we were young and very inexperienced. He would say, you know, try this. We weren't sophisticated enough that he could talk totally in musical terms, but he knew that we both had good ear for harmony and stuff like that, and he would either go over to the piano and just plunk out a little something and say, Peggy, you tried this, Denise, you know, you try that. I mean, look, with that kind of age difference, he didn't act like a stuffy older person. We looked up to him and respected him. We knew right away, even though we weren't super experienced, but to be in show business from such a young age, we knew there were people telling us to do stuff that they didn't know what they were talking about. But you knew he knew what he was talking about. And I think in order to get us, not that we wouldn't have sung the other songs, but the other songs, they were pretty. And the ones that Henry arranged, I don't know, but I think maybe he arranged all of the ones we did on Roulette. I'm not 100% sure. At least maybe what they considered the A-sides, I would think he did. Not Tomorrow, but Today, you know. And Little Ship was like, you know, but even at that age, I mean, we respected Henry and we thought that he had the best ideas and he led the musicians.
Not tomorrow, but tonight. Let's try some love and baby, we can start. If you just let me hold you in my arms real tight. Not tomorrow, but tonight. I got a feeling that we waited long enough and everything is gonna turn out right. I'm gonna kiss you and then my pet, yeah. Not tomorrow, but tonight.
Okay, my name is Artie Butler, and I'm an arranger, songwriter, composer, and I met Henry Glover actually when I was 14 years old, somewhere thereabout. And I'm now, I'll be 74 in December, so I met him. And I made a record for Deluxe Records, which, of course, never came out. I mean, it never was a hit that came out. Many years later, I started working in the recording industry at Bell Sound Studios, and Henry Glover was in and out of there all the time, and we became buddies. And he was the warmest, sweetest, funniest guy ever. And he was recording Dinah Washington, and he was recording all kinds of artists for Morris Levy, for Roulette. And when I became an arranger and working sessions, he hired me as an arranger. And I did projects for Henry. And we became fast friends. And we would go to a restaurant that was very popular called Alan Dick's, which was very popular in the music business. And Henry would tell me all kinds of stories about his making records for Sid Nathan at King Records and how he brought Eddie Smith over, who was a premier engineer at Bell Sound when I worked there. Then in 1967, I moved out to L.A., and I reached out to Henry in 67 or 68, I don't remember the year. I invited Henry to come out to stay in my place in L.A., and he said to me, I'm real proud of you, Artie. I see so much of the stuff that you're doing. I'm so proud of you. I wanted him to come out, and I said, bring your wife, whatever you want to do, come stay with me in L.A., and he was going to do it. And we joked about the old days in Bell Sound when I was a button pusher in L.A., and he says, I don't care what I read about you in the trades, you're still a button pusher. And he laughed, and we laughed. He said, I'm going to come out and stay with you. And then I know he collected those Corvairs, I think it was, the Chevy Corvairs. I think he was a collector of those cars. He had a couple of them. And then I got the sad news that he had passed away. And the trip to L.A. never happened. And I was so saddened by it. I really wanted to come out to L.A. because I wanted to bring him into the then contemporary end of the music business that was starting to happen, because music was starting to change and the way of making records was starting to change. And he was a real record man and a real music man, and he would have loved the way it was starting to happen, because he was just a wonderful guy and a great laugher. He was one of these guys, when he laughed, it's like he stuck his hand in the ground and braced himself to laugh, because he was a wonderful laugher. When I was a kid at Bell Sound and he was recording Dinah Washington, I watched how he was so professional, because Dinah was a phenomenal artist, but she was a diva. And he would massage the situation to get the project done. Watching guys like Henry was my college and high school education. It was his years of making records
it showed how we could get through any situation. And I learned a lot from guys like Henry, and no problem that ever came into the studio, whether it was man-made or musical, could get by Henry because of his years of expertise and his musicality.
And how old were you when you started at Bell Sound?
When I started at Bell Sound, I was 16 and a half.
How did you get that job?
I got a job in the record department of a Corvettes. It was a chain of department stores in Brooklyn. And there was this guy that would come in, I would say he was in his 40s maybe, and he always liked to find certain jazz albums and certain blues albums. And the other guys in the record department didn't want to climb up the ladders, you know, like you have those rolling ladders in a lawyer's office, you know. So I would do it for him. He was a very friendly guy, and we'd sit and talk about music. And at night, I was doing gigs on a weekend and playing in clubs. And he was a friendly guy, and he said, "Artie, you're a musician too, aren't you?" "Yeah." I said, "Yeah." He said, "How'd you like to get a job in a recording studio?" I said, "I'd love it." He says, "Well, that's my job." He says, "I work in a recording studio. Let me see if I can get you a meeting in a recording studio." She came back a week later. He said, "I got you an appointment. Call up for the meeting." So I called up, and I had the meeting. They hired me on the spot. On the spot. So my job was a button pusher, where I set up the studio. You know, the engineers would give me the setup they want for the microphones according to the size of the orchestra. And then I would sit in the control room in the corner behind the engineer, and I would take the take sheets, you know, take one, take two, take three. And the reason why they called it a button pusher is because the tape machines, you'd have to put the tape in the machine, close the gate, and press the buttons to start the machine. So if you had a mono machine and a two-track machine and a four-track machine and an eight-track machine, you had to press the buttons and do all of that on every machine. So your job was called a button pusher. And at the end of the session, you break it down, put away the mic cables, and put the mics back in the mic locker. So hence the job button pusher. And I got to know all the producers. Bell Sound was one of the busiest independent studios in New York, if not. I mean, the likes of every artist came in there. I mean, you name it. And the biggest of all of them was Lieberman Stoller. And they were coming in and doing everybody. Everybody. The Drifters, the Coasters, and God knows who, just everybody. And Henry Glover was in and out of there. Of course, I remembered Henry, and Henry knew me from when he went from the Deluxe thing. And Eddie Smith was the engineer that Henry brought in from King Records. And they were doing a ton of jingles and a ton of movie dates. And it was just the greatest experience. And sitting in the corner on my stool one night, and Lieberman Stoller producing, I forgot who the artist was, and I had a huge orchestra there, and the piano player couldn't play the part right. And I leaned over to Jerry Lieber, and I said, "I can play that part." And Jerry Lieber turned around and said, so they said, "After the session, we'll give you a chance." After the session, I went out in the studio, put on the earphones, and Mike Stoller pressed record, and I just aced it. And they said, "Quit your job and come work for us." They had their office in the Brill Building. And Henry Glover was, when I started being available, Henry Glover requested me to play piano on his sessions. I played on Dinah Washington sessions for him. I did sessions for him with Easier Said Than Done, Anita Humes and the Essex. And Henry was doing a lot of sessions, and he requested me on piano or organ or percussion on the sessions. And I played on a ton of sessions for Henry.
My friends all tell me, go to him, run to him, say sweet lovely things to him, and tell him he's the one. Deep in my heart, I know it, but it's so hard to show it, 'cause it's easier said than done. My buddies tell me, fly to him, sigh to him, tell him I would die for him, and tell him. Although he gives me a feeling that sets my heart a-reeling, yet it's easier said than done. Well, I know that I love him so, but I'm afraid that he'll never know. Because I guess so timid and shy, each time that I
did Henry ever give you any advice to be in the music business?
You know, I made him laugh a lot. He never really fathered me or mentored me. He was just like an older buddy. He was just very good to me.
How would you say, like, working on a Henry Glover session was different from, like, Lieber or Stoller? Was there anything
that
stands out?
I'll tell you how it was different. Everything was experienced, knowledge, and complete musical taste-based. It wasn't, I'll learn in the studio on the client's dime. When you showed up to make music, his instincts were right on. He knew what the project was walking in. Let's say you were going to record a song with anybody, and he knew what it was going to sound like, because he knew what to expect going in, and he knew the innards of it because of his musicality, and he knew how to get it done. So if an arranger showed up, because I was a piano player on a lot of sessions, and it wasn't quite right, he would listen to a rundown, and he'd say, oh, bar of 17, or fourth bar of the bridge, eighth bar, of the, tenth bar, and it's not quite right. Change it. And the arranger knew instinctively it wasn't right, and he fixed it. I remember a time when I was working at Bell Sound. Dinah Washington would show up. It was a three-hour session. You're doing three tunes. If it was a 7 to 10 session, she'd show up at 9:30. You rehearse the music, and then she just comes in and sings it. She just had the diva of divas. Whereas most singers show up for the 3 hours. You just rehearse the three songs, you record the tracks, and then she shows up and sings. That's just the way it was, because she was a diva. You know what I'm saying? So Henry would rehearse the tracks, get them recorded, work out all the goofs and the copying, you know. The music had to be copied for the musicians. So that's a hand process. So the arranger writes a score. The copyist takes the score, or blueprint, if you will, and writes the individual parts for the orchestra. So sometimes there's a goof. He's writing out for 25 violins, so sometimes there's a goof on one of the parts or the drum part. So when you rehearse the orchestra, you run it down and you say, oh, in measure 28, the trumpet has a wrong note. So she doesn't want to sit through all that rehearsing and picking out the bad notes. She wants to only show up when it's all rehearsed and sounding good. So she walked in once and she heard something she didn't like. She threw a fit. And she said to Henry, I don't like this thing. He says, they call it a clam when it's a mistake. She said, it's not a clam. And she said, I don't care if it's a clam or not. I don't like it. You got 5 minutes to fix it, Glover. She called him Glover. He says, okay, I'll change it. So Henry said to the arranger, his name was Belford Hendricks. And his nickname was Sinky. And he said, Sinky, change that measure. And he knew exactly what to do. And he fixed it. And how's this, Queenie? She said, you see? Once again, the queen was right. That's what you were dealing with. Henry knew how to massage it. And he came in with a bag of tricks that he always had, knew what to do, based on his expertise. And when you had an artist that was selling that many records, you had to keep her happy.
Hey, hey, I said, hey, brothers and sisters, now y'all now show me the way to get to Soulville. Show me the way to go home.
Show me the way.
Show me the way to get to Soulville.
Show me the way.
Because that's where I belong. Lord, show me the way to get to Soulville. Come on and take me way across the track.
Show me the way.
Where brothers and sisters and children too, they are sitting there racking them back. Gonna meet some soul folks who know all the tricks. Soul food. Well now,
it'll make you limber, it'll make you quick, it'll make you jump over the candlestick.
Yeah.
How did you hear the news when Henry passed away?
I think I saw it in one of the trades or something. And I tried to reach out to his family, but it was hard to reach for a while.
Why is Henry Glover important, and why should he be remembered?
Henry Glover, and there's a lot of me personal here, but Henry Glover comes from the school of where the music is important, and the music is real, and the music never suffered. By that I mean it was never compromised, and whatever groove he was working in, it came from his gut, and it came from his raw talent. And he just was one of these guys that was a real music man. And man, could we use some of those guys today. Because listen to the radio and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
I think there is an effort to get Henry into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I was wondering what your thoughts on that are.
Sign me up. Sign me up to support that. He was from the real, real music people who made records the real way. You know, when a guy shows up, a craftsman who knows what he's doing, and you hire a guy to come into your house and do something, and you look at him and you say, oh my God, look how nice he did the cabinets, the seams in the cabinets, the wood, the joints, everything is fine. The guy's a professional. Henry did that with music. He just had a wonderful ear. He had an innate sense of how the music should sound, and he had talent. He knew how to make it work. For a guy who writes music and executes it like myself, it's a pleasure to have a guy in the booth working with you like that, because he oversees it and he knows how to get it through the recording console and get the music made. He's a great liaison between the actual song and the end product because of his musicality and his years of experience. And that is so much needed today.
You've been listening to a special about Henry Glover and his career after he left King Records. For more information on Henry Glover and King Records, please visit our website, wvxu.org. Technical support from Andy Balterman. I'm Lee Hay.